There is a weekly, almost daily, toll of losses in Iraq. U.S. soldiers killed, battalion Polish and British forces, U.N. workers killed. The largest number killed, of course, have been Iraqi civilians. But Michael O'Hanlon finds some reason for optimism in Iraq, despite those continuing losses. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., and joins us from there. Mr. O'Hanlon, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
And you wrote in a piece that appeared in the Baltimore Sun last week that you thought that Ba'athist and foreign guerrillas have pretty much used up the panoply of tactics that are available to them.
That's right. What I mean by that, of course, is not that we're out of the woods, because they can keep using the same tactics over and over, and they're painful enough as is. But my point is simply, I think they've pretty much been playing out of the standard textbook of terrorist and insurgent methods that have been seen in other places. For example, the ambushing of convoys using improvised explosive devices and rocket-propelled grenades. This is largely what the Mujahideen did to the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 80s, to some extent what Hezbollah did to Israel in southern Lebanon a decade later. Mm-hmm. The use of truck bombs, of course, is what al-Qaeda has specialized in, as well as Hezbollah. And the using of rocket-propelled grenades and surface-to-air missiles to fire at aircraft has also been seen before in Somalia and elsewhere. Obviously, part of why they use these tactics is because they work, but now we can at least begin as a coalition to take responses. For example, everyone now knows they're potentially vulnerable to truck bombs. If there was any doubt about this before, it was ended when the UN compound was attacked in August and the Italians were attacked at Nasiriyah in November. The coalition has been attacked even when it's civilians from Japan or individuals working for the Red Cross. So there can be no doubt that if you are associated with the United States, you're vulnerable and you should protect against truck bombs, protect against assassination. The same thing is now happening with United States helicopter flights. We're trying to be more judicious in when we fly and where we fly. And I hope that we're not going to have another month like November ever again, or even one half as bad.
What about the state of order and everyday life in Baghdad and the rest of the country at this particular point?
This is a complex story, Scott, because there are certainly some things that are getting much better, whether it's electricity or whether it's water, telephone service, sewage. Most of these sorts of basic utilities are functioning roughly at pre-war levels. Cooking fuel, heating fuel, as winter approaches and arrives in Iraq, these are also now in much more abundance than they were shortly after Saddam fell. And again, the levels are nearing or exceeding where they were before the war. So that's good news. The key challenge remains security on the street. That's the one trend line that hasn't gotten better. But at least for the Iraqi population, I don't think it's getting worse either. And with certain tactical adjustments the coalition might make, I'm hopeful that we can improve that as well.
Isn't the crime problem aggravated by the fact that there's widespread unemployment?
Absolutely. It's probably in the general vicinity of 50%. And not only does it increase the likelihood of crime, it increases the likelihood that non-Ba'athist Iraqis will choose to take up arms against the United States if we cannot improve their lot fairly soon.
Is there some tension, Mr. O'Hanlon, between the mission that U.S. military commanders understandably see, which is to protect their own people from attack, and this whole process of nation-building, as some people frankly acknowledge it, which in fact there's no way of evading the fact that your people have to be exposed to the population?
Yes, there is tension. And my colleague Ken Pollack, for example, who's just back from Iraq more recently than I, has recently argued we have to do more foot patrols in some of the major Iraqi cities because Iraqis are afraid of violence from their own countrymen. And we are not doing enough to stop that by rolling through these streets at 30 miles an hour inside Bradley fighting vehicles and Abrams tanks.
It does strike me, Mr. O'Hanlon, that a lot of what you're talking about seems to suggest the need for greater physical presence of U.S. forces, which is to say more than are on the ground now. And that doesn't seem to be a popular idea to make in an election year.
Divisional commanders in Iraq say they have enough troops for the missions they are doing. But that raises the question about whether the missions are the correct ones and have they been comprehensively enough and broadly enough defined. If we are not doing enough foot patrols to make the Iraqi population safe, maybe the mission needs to change. If we are not guarding enough ammunition dumps to prevent Iraqi criminals and extremists from picking up arms and using them against us, maybe the mission needs to be broadened to include those sorts of tasks as well. On the other hand, there are parts of the country where security is getting better, so it may be possible to keep overall numbers in Iraq more or less where they are by reinforcing certain areas of the country by reducing in others.
Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, thank you very much.
Nice to be with you, Scott.